Good morning, everyone.
So last class, we started talking about gravitational waves. We did some linear perturbation theory where we considered linear metric perturbations around some background solution and derived the equations that those satisfy. And then we briefly talked about gravitational wave propagation around a flat background. How we can, in that particular case, we can write things in this TT transverse traceless gauge, where basically we just have two non-trivial metric components corresponding to the two physical polarizations of the gravitational wave, the plus and the cross. So we're going to begin today's class by talking about doing a calculation of how one might actually generate gravitational waves due to some matter source. So here we're going to be not assuming vacuum. We're going to assume we have some matter sources, but we will be working in sort of the weak field regime. So we'll be perturbing around Minkowski space. So our background is Minkowski, but we have matter. So that means we can't use this TT gauge, but we can still use the Lorentz gauge. And our equations for the trace-reversed metric perturbation H bar, just a box, which is just the box of the flat of Minkowski equals minus 16 pi TAB in the Lorentz gauge. This is the equation we were done last time, and I just set the Riemann tensor term to zero since we have a flat background. So in general, when you have matter sources, you have other non-radiative metric degrees of freedom, corresponding to basically the just kind of Newtonian potential of the matter sources and so on. But we'll basically just do this calculation assuming the Lorentz gauge, but no other conditions. And then when we get an answer, we'll sort of project out the transverse traceless part, which is what you could connect to what would be the TT metric perturbation in the wave zone where you can enforce that gauge. Okay, so to solve the wave equation with the source, we're going to use the usual method of writing down the Green's function. So the Green's function, you'll recall, is just the solution to the wave equation for a delta function source. And here, the boxes respect to this unbarred coordinate. Okay, so the sort of the flat space wave equation Green's function is sort of well known. Perhaps you've come across it before, and I'll write it down here. So here remember, I is just the spatial components. And this theta is just the Heaviside step function. So it's one, the positive arguments, and zero for negative ones. Yeah, so this is the Green's function for the retarded solution. And then we can use this to solve the wave equation for an arbitrary source. So the general solution is just going to be we take our Green's function and we integrate it with our source, in this case the stress energy tensor. And then if we just plug in this definition here, right, so here I've gone ahead and used this delta function to go to to basically get rid of the time. And so now we're basically integrating over the retarded time, so which I'm going to call TR here, which is T minus XI minus X bar I. So if we have some, we're interested at the value at XI of this metric perturbation. We're integrating over a different X bar I at some time t. Then we need to look at the past light cone at this retarded time. Any questions so far? Yeah, so basically we're gonna wanna work out this integral, and it'll be easier to do if we go into Fourier space. So I'm just going to have a tilde to indicate the Fourier transform with respect to time. And then just plug in that expression there. An integral over the retarded time now, and a spatial volume integral. And here again, I just use this definition of the retarded time there to substitute for t. So we can use this and this to Fourier transform the stress energy tensor. So far we've written this down with the space-time indices, but in fact, we really just need to calculate the spatial ones, and then, let me say this a different way. Recall that we're working in Lorentz gauge, right? So in Fourier space, we can write this as, so here this would be, so that's the Lorentz gauge in this position domain. And so in Fourier space, we're just going to have that. So basically, once we have the spatial components, we can use these to calculate these other ones using the Lorentz condition. All right, so to simplify this a bit further, we need to make some assumptions about our sources and where we're observing these gravitational waves. So the picture we have in mind here is we have some source region here, we have some matter, and the sort of that has some characteristic size. So this is where we have our black holes orbiting or some star oscillating or whatever is producing the gravitational waves. And then we're going to assume that the wavelength of the gravitational wave is large compared to this source region. So for example, that happens if you have compact sources that are moving non-relativistically. So we'll get to sort of examples of when that holds and when that doesn't hold in just a second. But for now, we're going to assume that this wavelength is long compared to the source region. And then we're going to assume we have a third, even larger length scale, which is the distance at which we're observing. So we're imagine that we're sort of observing here at some distance r. And so we have r is much, much greater than the wavelength of the gravitational waves, which is 1 over their frequency. And that's much bigger than the characteristic size of the source. OK, so what is that bias? That basically means that we can approximate when we have expressions like this. Basically, we can just approximate this by r, because the main contribution is the distance from the source and not some small correction from one place in the source to another compared to the distance of the observer. Okay. All right, and I guess I dropped that here. All So that allows us to simplify that and pull that outside the integral. And so now we just want to worry about this integral over the TAB. Yeah, so to simplify this, we're going to basically do reverse integration by parts. Okay, and yeah, so you know, if we take this derivative and apply the product rule, then we get basically this term, and then this term. So we can write it this way, and now I claim this is what is this contribution when we do the integral. We have a total derivative here, and we're integrating over it. What do we get?
The integrant itself. I mean, inside the derivative, x times.
Yeah. So yeah, and but in particular, we can just set this to zero by because we just get a you know surface term or whatever, and we can take the integral to the regime where the sources vanish. So we can set this to zero. This is total derivative or total integral. And then this one, we can, yeah, so basically we're going to use conservation of stress energy, but in the Fourier domain. Basically that tells us if we look at the... Yeah, if we look at the time component, we just pulled on I omega here. And then yeah, so that in general, yeah, and then we can use that here to rewrite this in terms of the TJ0 component. All right, so far, what do we have? Yeah, and here I just basically symmetrize this. And we're going to do this reverse integration by parts one more time. Okay, so same tricks here. Then again, we can get rid of this one and apply this, and we get another I omega here. And yeah, and so now we're basically done here. So we're going to call this it's the Fourier transform of the quadruple moment tensor here. So this is basically the energy density, and this is just xi, xj, two different coordinates. Yeah, so if we just put this back in there, we can arrive at our final expression. So that's in the Fourier domain. Should be a bar there too. And then if we transform back, these two omegas, I omega squared would be two time derivatives. And we should remember we're evaluating at the retarded time. Yeah, so that gives us the spatial components of this metric perturbation. So now if we want to connect that to what the TT components would be in the wave zone, we have a little bit more work to do. Yeah, so we want to basically get the transverse traceless part of this. So to do that, let's introduce this projection tensor. So this basically takes the part of the tensor that's not in the direction that's kind of pointing towards the observer. And so it subtracts out the part that's pointing to the observer, and that gives you the transverse part. So that's one T. And now to get the other T, we need to get rid of the trace of this as well, right? So that's the TT component, basically projecting out the transverse part and the trace of this guy. We get this, and then if we write that again in terms of this quadrupole moment, we get our final expression. And here, this kind of script I is the reduced quadrupole moment, where we just subtract out the trace. Of the spatial components. So any questions about that? Did I make any mistakes? You know, one question you might have is, sorry, was there a question? Or?
Oh, I was wondering why the transverse trace discondition is imposed here.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's a little bit, it's a little bit of a subtle point that I didn't kind of fully justify, but, so in this source zone, there'll basically be, in addition to kind of these TT components, there'll be other degrees of freedom that will correspond to gauge and to non-radiative metric degrees of freedom. You know, if you have like two stars or something, they also have their gravitational potential and so on. But the basic idea is you can decompose like this one into this contribution and these other non-radiative ones. And then when you try to connect that to the wave zone where you can impose that gauge, basically these are the ones that will correspond to the actual physical gravitational wave degree of freedom when you go to the wave zone. Yeah, any other questions? Yeah, so you might wonder why sort of the leading contribution to the gravitational waves actually comes from this quadrupole of the matter, as opposed to like the monopole or the dipole. I mean, so if we just look at the lower order monopoles of the matter distribution, the first one we have is the monopole, where we just integrate the energy density over the source zone. And that of course just gives us the total mass. So just by kind of dimensional analysis, if we were gonna have some radiation, I'm going to now sort of restore units for this. We have g over c squared, like m over r. So why wouldn't we get any sort of radiation of this form?
I'm tempted to say it's not inverse squares, and so, I mean, it doesn't scale like radiation does.
Not quite. So this is how it is gonna scale for the radiation as well. This one over r, that's how we expect like a wave to decay, right? The wave amplitude, but it's more about this m here. I mean, so for radiation, we expect something oscillating, right? So we expect some time dependence there, right?
Yeah.
But for some source, we expect this monopole, which is just the total mass to change.
Okay.
Yeah, so in this case, you know, just by, you know, conservation of mass, we don't expect the source zone to be able to make its mass oscillate, right? Because the mass is conserved.
I see.
You know, in particular, for example, if we have just a spherically symmetric space-time, we know that we just, you know, by Birkhoff's theorem, outside the source zone, we just get a Schwarzschild, and there's no gravitational radiation or anything. So we can also think about the next higher order besides monopole, which would be a dipole. So it's just integrating energy density with sort of one power the spatial coordinate. So again, like, why don't we expect some so here, just by kind of dimensional analysis, we expect like one time derivative of this dipole moment if we were to get some gravitational radiation like this. So if we just look at this quantity, what is this dipole? Yeah, what's another term for that?
Isn't it center of mass?
Yeah, exactly. So it's the center of mass. So again, do we expect the center of mass to change?
No.
Yeah, not if we're in sort of, if we choose our right coordinates, we can make that disappear just by, because there shouldn't be a change in momentum. Yeah, so again, that's why I don't get dipole radiation like we do in electromagnetism, where you have, you know, charges of opposite sign, for example. And so then, you know, after monopole, dipole, then we get quadrupole. Yeah, so one thing I do want to come back to is, you know, in deriving this formula, which is usually called the quadrupole formula, we did make additional assumptions besides just that we're in the weak field regime. In particular, you know, these make some extra assumptions. So just to illustrate that those don't always have to be true, you know, one thing we mentioned earlier in this class was this phenomenon of the super radiant instability, right? Where you could, if you have a massive scalar or vector boson, those could actually form clouds around black holes, which would oscillate. So we did those calculations in kind of the non-relativistic regime, where these clouds sit far away from the black hole, and they'll, you know, it should be sort of a decent approximation to consider them kind of weak field sources. So just recall, we had like the black hole, then we had these clouds, and their sort of characteristic size was this kind of analogous quantity to the Bohr radius, right? Which was, we wrote it as 1 over alpha times mu. So mu is the mass of the scalar or vector boson. So 1 over this would be kind of its Compton wavelength. And then alpha here was this dimensionless combination of the black hole mass and mu. And then we do these computations in the regime where this is much smaller than one. So this sits far away from the black hole. And so these oscillating clouds will actually produce gravitational waves. So they're sort of oscillating with frequency mu, and then they'll produce that. And since the stress energy tensor is quadratic in the bosonic field, it'll produce gravitational radiation at a frequency that's twice mu. So yeah, so the question is, does the quadrupole formula apply to this situation? Yeah, so if we, so basically we want to see if this condition holds. So gravitational wave is 1 over this. And then in comparison, the characteristic size is RB. And I said that alpha is much smaller than one, so this is actually going to be much bigger than this, right? So we don't have this this condition here, and the quadrupole formula doesn't apply. I mean, we could still use weak field gravity, but basically, the way to think of it is because this sort of the characteristic size of the source is large compared to the wavelength, you can't just, it's different parts of the source are not going to produce gravitational wave radiation coherently because they can be separated by more than a wavelength. So you have to sort of add them up in a way where they can't, like, you know, different parts of the source can produce gravitational waves that can constructively or destructively add together. And so basically the, you know, up to here, we could have, we did make use of that assumption, but, you know, here and on, we did make use of that assumption. So that's just something to keep in mind. The sort of canonical case where the quadrupole formula does apply is to consider a binary, like, you know, two black holes or two stars that are orbiting each other at a larger separation. So let's see what's this. So let's say we just have two masses, call them M, some separation 2R, and you say they're going around in a circle. Then the gravitational radiation is again twice the frequency of the orbit. Basically go through a gravitational wave cycle every time these switch places. If we write in terms of the period, we can just apply, you know, assuming this separation is large, we'll just use the Newtonian expression. Yeah, and so basically, you know, here R is the characteristic size of our source. And if we can assume that this is much less than one, or equivalently, the R is much greater than M, then the wavelength of the gravitational waves, which is 1 over the frequency, will be large compared to the objects. And that's basically just because they're moving non-relativistically. Once they start moving near the speed of light, then those become comparable. Okay, any questions about that? Okay, so if there are no questions, the last thing I'm going to do in class is derive an energy and angular momentum that we can associate with gravitational waves. And we'll do this by sort of defining an effective stress energy tensor associated with the gravitational waves. So there's sort of no, completely gauge invariant way to locally measure the energy in gravitational waves. But in the weak field regime, we can define sort of this effective measure if we average over the wavelength of the gravitational waves, and these can be defined without ambiguity as fluxes at infinity. So. Yeah, so the basic idea to derive this effective stress energy tensor associated with the gravitational waves is to go to second order in perturbation theory, where we consider a metric perturbation around some background solution. So we have our background metric, then we have our first our linear order metric perturbation, which we worked out in detail last time in class, and then one can go to second order. And then if we calculate the associated Riemann tensor, so we can again write this as a expansion. So there's the zeroth order piece, first order, and second order. And again, we're going to restrict to considering just vacuum cases where our background solution is a vacuum solution of GR. So this is just zero. So last time in class, we basically worked out the first order equations. So here we're going to just restrict to vacuum regardless. So we worked out the first order equations, which is basically the Einstein tensor first order, where we evaluate that. on the metric perturbation of first order, and we set that to 0. And now if we go to second order, we basically get two contributions, right? So to begin with, we have to expand the Einstein tensor up to second order. And for the first order piece, we need to evaluate that for both the first order and the second order metric perturbation. So the first order contribution is already 0, so we can ignore that. So we just get the second order contribution. And then for the second order piece, we just need to evaluate that on the first order metric perturbation. And so here we're going to get basically quadratic terms in this one. And so the idea of defining this effective stress energy tensor is basically just to take this term from the left-hand side to the right-hand side and call that the stress energy tensor. And you know, this kind of makes sense. You know, first of all, just because we have Einstein tensor equals something. So here TAB is going to be the effective stress energy tensor over gravitational waves, and we just defined it as the second order GAB divided by 8 pi. So you know, first of all, we get some symmetric tensor, right? Because the Einstein tensor is symmetric. And second of all, this TAB will satisfy stress energy conservation. Can anyone tell me why that's true? It's just the answer. It's always the same answer, right? Yeah, it's just the Bianchi identity. If we just apply the Bianchi identity here, that guarantees that this should also be 0. So we can, so it's kind of reasonable to think of a stress energy tensor. But again, we should emphasize that it's not gauge invariant. And we're going to sort of get around that by averaging over the wavelength of the gravitational waves. Yeah, so this computation is a bit messy, so I'm not going to go through it. And just kind of write down the answer. But maybe just say a few words about the steps, and then we'll write down the answer. So basically, we want to write down this We want to do the same kind of arguments we did last time in class, but now expanding this to the second order. And we basically take all the terms that are now quadratic in the metric. And we can, apply the equations of motion. And we'll also use basically the fact that we're averaging over wavelengths. Whenever we have some quantity like this, where we average these time or spatial derivatives should average to zero. And we can also use that whenever we have some quantity where we take one derivative and then multiply it by x, we can basically switch those by picking up a minus sign, just using the fact that this should be zero. So that means that this we can just switch these as well. So if you apply arguments like that, you get the following expression in general. And here, again, I'm using these brackets to indicate this average over wavelength. Okay, and that actually simplifies if you assume this Lorentz condition and the traceless. Well, yeah, and so I should say here also that I've written it sort of around flat space with these partials, but actually you can do the same computation around some non-flat background, in which case you basically the partials go to just the covariant of the background. But in transverse traceless gauge, this simplifies a lot. Get rid of these trace terms. Okay, so in this gauge, it's not too bad. And we, again, we can kind of see it makes sense. We have something that's this energy density is kind of quadratic in our field. We have derivative, we have basically it's quadratic in the derivatives of the metric tensor. And if we, for example, take the plane wave solution that we wrote down last time. All right, just in terms of H plus and H cross amplitude, and plug that in here. Actually, sorry. Let's before we do that, let's note that we can So we have the stress energy tensor, and we can use that to define an energy, and then we'll also define an angular momentum as well. So for energy, we would just basically integrate this energy density, which is the 0, 0 component, over some time slice. And then for the plane wave, our energy is, you know, proportional to the amplitude squared, and then also proportional to the frequency squared. Similar to the energy, this kind of total energy we're associating with a gravitational wave, we can also define an energy flux. So to get that, we just basically see with the flux through some surface with unit normal and I here. So if we take some surface at large distances, then we can calculate the flux of energy associated with this stress energy tensor, and that'll give us a flux. And that'll give us this gravitational wave energy flux. And we could do the same thing for the angular momentum. And if we basically take this expression here and plug in our quadrupole formula, which I guess I've erased or is under here, we can finally arrive at some energy and angular momentum flux associated directly with some oscillating matter source. I'll to get these, you take the expression for the metric perturbation in terms of the this is reduced quadrupole moment with the tilde, and then you plug them into this expression here. So now we pick up these extra derivatives. So now we actually have three time derivatives here, for example, for the energy, and 2 and 3 here for the angular momentum. And then we arrive at these expressions. Yeah, so any questions about that? So I guess in tutorial earlier this week, you used these expressions to basically derive how an orbiting binary, how its orbital energy and angular momentum would change, basically because you're losing energy and angular momentum to the gravitational waves, and how that would, I guess in the case of an eccentric orbit, that would cause it to circularize. It acts to reduce the eccentricity. Okay, so I think we're out of time, but I'm happy to stick around and answer any questions.